across the country and around the world.
Different programs and different points of view.
This is TalkZone.com.
Hello, everyone. Hub Arkish, along with Mike Wilkening and Jim Clemens, welcoming you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL, the NBA, and college hoops as well.
We talk about mid-major Cinderellas, plus a rundown of the NFL owners' meetings.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Thank you all so much for joining us again this week on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm the publisher and editor, Hub Arkish, and I have senior editor Mike Wilkening alongside, along with our co-hosts throughout the basketball season, Jim Clemens, assistant coach of the L.A. Lakers. And we are joined just about every week by our very favorite NBA insider. That would be Steve Kyler, the publisher of HoopsWorld.com. For the very best in NBA inside information, go to HoopsWorld.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And Steve, let me just ask you real quickly, because I keep putting Jimmy on the spot with his own ball club. As we tape this show, the Lakers are getting ready to take on the Spurs. They've won six straight. It looks like they're streaking at the right time, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, this is a team that knows when to win. And you look at some of the young teams in the NBA and you say, you know, we get all excited with the young guys, the Derrick Roses, the Tariq Evans, but it really comes down to, can you play well in March and April? And the Lakers have, you know, they've had their injuries and I think some chemistry issues along the way. I'd never put coach on the spot with that, but I think they've started to figure out how to play with each other and play the right way. And I'm sure coach wants to see them playing for 48 minutes the right way. But like you said, Hub, this is absolutely getting hot when it matters. This is figuring out the right way to play with each other down the stretch and roll into the playoffs, you know, on the right foot.
Jimmy, the only slight negative recently, early this week, another nick, shall we say, to Andrew Bynum. The early report was hopefully not too bad. What can you tell us about Bynum's leg?
Well, we brought him on the trip with us, and I think that's a good thing because if it's worse than there were reports, then we certainly would have left him behind, and there wouldn't be any therapy, you know, hands-on stuff. So the fact that we brought him with us is a good sign, but he certainly is not going to play on this road trip. And Steve, you're absolutely right. We have had issues, but this is going to be a very difficult road trip with us, with tonight's stop in San Antonio, then move on to Oklahoma City, Houston, and New Orleans, and Atlanta before we head home. So this is going to be a very telltale road trip for us.
You know, Steve, I'm looking at the standings, and again, we tape late in the week so we can air around the country in over 100 markets on the weekend. But, of course, you got the Lakers sitting there with about a 5-game bulge over the Nuggets and the Jazz. And then, as usual, in the West, you've got the next 7 or 8 teams all within about 3 or 4 of each other in the loss column. And right now, the hot team looks to be the Phoenix Suns. They've won 5 straight at the time of this taping. And Amari Stoudemire, averaging 32 points a game during the 5-game winning streak, they're back to that let's run all night and score as much as we can style, and you know, they've beaten Utah and Portland in the last 2 weeks. Can Phoenix's style work for them in the postseason?
Well, I think the one difference in their style this year, maybe more than any other year, is they actually are playing a little more defense than they're known for. And a lot of it's coming from their second unit. A lot of it is coming from the bench. And, you know, guys like Jared Dudley are really getting after people when they're on the floor. And I think that what it's doing is taking away a possession here and there. And that's something, you know, under Mike D'Antoni, the Suns just really didn't do. We're going to try to outscore you every night. I think when the game slows down a little bit and you're facing tougher defense, of teams and veteran teams that kind of know how to take things away, Phoenix is going to run into some struggles. But, you know, you mentioned Amari Stoudemire. It's funny how a guy playing for a paycheck tends to show up huge. You know, this is Amari's chance to prove that he is an elite-level player worthy of the maximum contract dollars he's going to look for this summer. And I think that's a motivation you can never look past. And, you know, and Steve Nash, I don't know what's going on with him, but he just seems to get better as he gets older. He has become that smart, savvy player. And if both of those guys are healthy, Nash and Stoudemire, I think they're going to be a formidable opponent just simply because they can get up and down the floor a lot better than most of the teams they're going to face.
You know, Jimmy, the Suns have spent the better part of the last 2 years trying to deal Stoudemire to avoid giving him the max contract. Now, after this season, their choice is to lose him for nothing or to give it to him and hope that he will take it from them, particularly if they make a run deep in the playoffs. It would seem they almost have to offer it to him. Do the Suns have a choice but to try and re-sign sign him for maximum dollars? And do you suspect ever with players like this that too much damage has been done, that maybe he would move on just because of pride?
Well, I'm happy for him. And the fact is that there's probably a sign and trade for him somewhere out there, Hub, knowing the fact that he's been mature enough to, at least on the appearance sake, put this behind him, and it hasn't destroyed his concentration, because obviously there may be, in his mindset, bigger fish to fry. But he certainly proved himself worthy that he can play in the pressure cooker. A lot of guys would have folded their tents and went home by now because of the pressure to compete and to play for the, you know, for the contract that's out there. And somebody's going to give it to him, like I say, either Phoenix or a sign and trade with someone else.
Hey, Wilkie, Mike Wilking, our senior editor at Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Very quickly, if you would, update us on the status of George Karl. We know he returned to the bench briefly. It now looks like he will miss the rest of the regular season undergoing cancer treatment. Give us what facts you can about what his status is.
As we tape this, from all accounts, it looks like he may be out until at least the playoffs. Reportedly, has suffered some complications medically as he undergoes cancer treatment. As we stand right now, they're one game up in the division race trying to hold off Utah. But what we do know, again, is he's undergoing these treatments. Maybe the postseason is when he'll be back. But at this point, certainly the focus is making sure he gets back to health and is ready to get back to the sidelines. But from all accounts, it doesn't look like he's going to be back at least until the postseason.
All right, Steve and Jim, hold that thought, please. We've got to take a quick commercial break here, and I want to get your thoughts on the status of the Nuggets, who've dropped three of their last five, and George Karl, as well as more NBA talk in just a moment. Hal Barkas, Jim Clemens, and Mike Wilkening bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. We are joined by the publisher of HoopsWorld.com, Steve Kyler. You've got to get to HoopsWorld.com on your computer if you want the very best on NBA inside information. And Steve, as we went to that commercial break, we were talking a little bit about the unfortunate situation of George Karl. We were talking a little bit off the air, and you made a great point about really, I think, the class that everybody, the organization, ownership, Coach Karl, have tried to handle the situation with. And yet, any light you can shed on it going forward, because it's one that is still not likely to be rectified in the near future.
Well, Hub, as we were talking about, you know, this is a situation where a lot of this medical stuff with Coach Karl was on the table, and I think a lot of people within the organization knew that cancer was in the future for George, and they went ahead and extended his contract anyway. You know, George was probably going to be the highest profile free agent coach out there this summer, and it really looked like talks were going nowhere. And even in the face of all this, the Nuggets have absolutely stood by George Karl and have been very supportive of him. You know, in an age where every team seems to be making those cold business decisions and looking at the bottom line more than the people involved, it was kind of noble, especially for a Nuggets organization that really doesn't have a lot of credit for taking care of their people quite like they did with George Karl.
And, you know, Jimmy, we talked a little bit last week. I know you indicated Adrian Dantley more than capable of running this ball club, and he's running it in George Karl's image or system. The fact that they've dropped three of their last five over the last 10 days or so, 14 days, you know, I don't think that you look at that as a trend so much as it's late in the season and everybody hits a spurt like that. Or is it possible that they're starting to miss Karl's presence?
Well, I think more than what's happening, Hub, is the fact that these teams know that George isn't there, and they're trying to find that little clink in the armor. And what the guys have to do is rally around. I'm quite sure they understand what needs to be done, but that their behavior in order as athletes to get it done is right now what Adrian's probably trying to stress to them.
Steve, I've got about three pages of notes here, but I think I'll just tee you up first on Gilbert Arenas and the Washington Wizards. I'll highlight it. It looks like he's going to do at least 90 days in the slammer. It doesn't look like the Wizards are going to be able to get away with voiding his contract, according to what NBA union folks are saying. What's the latest on all this as far as you know?
Well, everything kind of comes down to what ultimately does the judge decide in terms of sentencing this week. You know, Gilbert, part of his plea agreement was that he wouldn't do more than 6 months. However, the judge, when he accepted that, said, you know, that's great that you guys agreed to that. I'm still withholding the right to impose whatever sentence is required under law, and that could be as much as 5 years. The one thing that the prosecutors have said very clearly was that Gilbert has shown no remorse in his actions other than concern for his own career. So it doesn't look good for Gilbert. That could certainly be the opening that the judge could have to really whack Gilbert pretty hard on this one, because it's a gun-related issue in Washington, D.C., where there's more gun-related crime than anywhere else in the country. And they have very tough laws, and this is a chance for them to say, look, it doesn't matter who you are or what you do, you could really face some severe penalties, toe the line on the law here. And I think Gilbert may be made of an example of here.
And Steve, what's the latest you're hearing on Flip Saunders' future with the Wizards?
Well, he is actually fairly secure. I think the one thing with the Wizard that's probably up in the air with everything is status of ownership. When Abe Pollin passed away this year, you know, that triggered a clause with his minority partner, Ted Leonsis, where he has the option to basically purchase the remaining portion of the team that he does not already own, and that process is undergoing. So there could be an ownership change with the Washington Wizards here this offseason, and then it becomes up to Ted whether or not he wants to start replacing people at the top, whether that's GM Ernie Grunfeld, whether that's Flip, whether that's trying to void Gilbert Arenas' contract. I think a lot of this stuff is kind of interrelated as much as it has to do with ownership and ultimately what Ted wants to do once he owns it.
Jimmy, a report from a game earlier this week on Tuesday, I believe against Charlotte. Flip Saunders chose to put forward Andre Blatch on the bench early in the ballgame. When he told him to go back in the game in the fourth quarter, Blatch apparently refused. I guess when the wheels come off, they're off completely. And in a situation like that, you would think it would be up to Flip Saunders to do something pretty dramatic to make sure his players know who's running the ship.
That's unfortunate, because we played them on Sunday, and they didn't have a successful road trip, and they knew that they had a rough stint going back. And as we were talking, you know, this is a player that they were trying to see what he had in his tank, and they were trying to give him more touches and see if he was really going ready to be the star player. And behavior like that, once again, is going to set them back on their heels, and it's going to have everyone wondering if if his contract is due, they want to give him an extension. Is he the type of player that you really want around? So once again, he's hurting himself as well as the franchise with this type of behavior, guys.
Hey, Steve, I've only got 20, 30 seconds left, but what do the Wizards do during the offseason? Where is the hope lie for them now?
Well, they have a draft pick, and they certainly can have some free agent dollars from the moves that they've made, but a lot of it is going to be how much of this roster can you get rid of. Some of it's going to leave through free agency, but they've got to be smart about handing out the contracts this summer, and that's something under this leadership they've really not been very good at. So for them, they'll have the ability, the flexibility, at least with cap room, to go out and try to make some moves, but who really wants to kind of be involved if it doesn't look like it's headed in the right direction?
All right, Steve Kuyler of HoopsWorld.com. Steve, thank you so much for joining us again this week. We'll track you down next week. Right now, we take a quick commercial break. It's tournament time, March Madness. We check in on college hoops in a moment. It's time to talk a little March Madness. We've got the college tournaments underway. Of course, the NC2A, the big one, the NIT, is winding down. And we welcome in one of our favorite college hoops experts, Matt Norlander, who runs collegehoopsjournal.com. And Matt is also a regular contributor to The Dagger, which can be found at Yahoo Sports' basketball blog section on the College Basketball Channel. Matt, thank you so much for taking time out to join us. And I'm guessing as people check in with you this week, most of the conversations start with Northern Iowa, maybe Cornell, one of the others. But Northern Iowa is my favorite. How impressive is it for this mid-major to have accomplished what they've accomplished after knocking off Kansas?
You know, it's funny because it's impressive, but it's not surprising. Because of the fact, I mean, Northern Iowa is a very good team. And, you know, they're 30-4, guys, and they were solid all year. And two of those four losses were befuddling. I mean, they dropped one to DePaul back at the beginning of the year, and then I believe they bookended it with a loss against Evansville, who was awful. But, you know, the Missouri Valley has always been, or not always been, but frequently been very legitimate in the tournament, and has had years where it sent three or four teams. It wasn't as good as it's been, you know, 5-6 years back, but it wasn't a strong league this year. And this was beating Kansas was a huge surprise, but UNI was underseeded to begin with. I wrote a column on College Hoops Journal after Selection Sunday, and I said this was the worst seeding job in the committee's history. And, you know, I didn't do it to be malicious. It was just a matter of fact. I mean, there were tons of teams that were seeded incorrectly, and Northern Iowa did not deserve to be in that 8-9 game. They're a 6. You could even argue a 5. So that was more like, you know, the Panthers knocking out the Jayhawks maybe in a Sweet 16 game, or at least that's what it should have been. Very impressive what they've done. And, you know, Ali Farouk Manesh has become a name that everyone knows how to spell correctly and, you know, is bouncing around households. And the thing about it is he's not even the most critical player on their team, but everyone's going to think it, and that's fine. But, you know, Jordan Eglesetter is kind of the key because he's the big body down low. He's got that farm boy strength, and he doesn't, you know, he's that guy that doesn't mind getting really sweaty and bothering the heck out of you at the local YMCA. They can definitely beat Michigan State. I agree with you. I think they are going to win, and that's primarily because Lucas is out. Kalen Lucas is done with that Achilles, and Michigan State's a little banged up. Delvin Rowe, I believe, has a knee injury, and we still don't know the status of Chris Allen, if he's going to even be able to play in their Sweet 16 game. So I like Northern Iowa to flirt with a trip to Indianapolis, and that's good because we have five non-major teams that are going to be playing for a chance to get to the Elite Eight. And I'm hoping that at least one or two of them are playing come Saturday and Sunday, because I would like to see, you know, not necessarily a repeat of George Mason, because I think Northern Iowa is better than George Mason was in 06, but I'd like to see a small guy get there, because I appreciate the storylines that come with it, even if television ratings don't reflect that.
Well, Matt, is this an anomaly, or this is something that true basketball fans can look forward to as we move forward? Because I'm looking at the records of not only Northern Iowa, Butler, St. Mary's, and Cornell. I mean, they had outstanding years regardless of who they were playing.
Yeah, tough question. I think it is not an anomaly as of where we are right now. Like, right now we have three real non-majors, and then Butler and Xavier, who also are small schools, but, you know, Xavier is legit, and Butler's been good for a decade now, that are in the Sweet 16. I think from this point forward, and to a certain extent it's always been like this, we're going to have schools like this reach the second weekend. I don't think it's going to be a common, like, let's go hypothetical here. Let's say it's St. Mary's that reaches the Final Four, since we haven't talked about them yet. You know, that's going to be the second time in 4 years that we'll have had a school, you know, a small school, reach the Final Four. And if that happens, I mean, if any of those schools reach it, that's going to be, you know, the question you just asked me, Jim, is what's going to be talked about come Monday. You know, is this what we're going to expect every 3 or 4 years? I don't necessarily believe so, because I think the talent that's recruited to the high level is still always going to be there. Like, there is a talent gap. You know, anyone that scouts NBA prospects or whatever, you can clearly see that schools like Syracuse, West Virginia, North Carolina, Kansas, like, the players they're getting are clearly a cut above what players that are going to Northern Iowa and Cornell. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it's a confluence of events. It's the fact that they're playing on a huge stage, you know, with millions of people watching. These are 19- and 20-year-old kids. Like, that affects them. They're emotional beings, you know. And I think that there's always going to be the chance for it, but I don't know if we'll necessarily get another year where we have five schools from non-major conferences reaching the Sweet 16, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years. It'll still happen, but I don't know if it'll be consistent.
Matt, talk about what Washington's been able to do. I mean, they're a double-digit seed. I know they're a high major team, but what they've done is very impressive. And, you know, there's not a ton of publicity that's going to them right now, probably because of all the talk about the mid-majors. Can you talk about what Lorenzo Romar has built in Washington?
Yeah, I actually was writing. I was writing my previews on College Hoops Journal today, and I was reading around this week, and I was just, everyone's breaking down these games, and I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna be snarky about it, and I'm just gonna write what I don't like about all these teams. And Washington, I really went after, but that was more for a writing bit. To be honest, I do like Washington because they've been able to be consistent, and Quincy Pondexter, I think, is the most underrated player in the nation. I truly do. He's got shoulders that just, oh my gosh. I mean, he looks like he could play in the NFL when he's out on the court. You know, for the first time, Washington has shown the ability to play consistently. They looked as good as they looked today all season long, but they only looked that good, you know, in polka dot patterns all over the season. But now they've won 9 in a row. They beat a Marquette team that they should have beaten, because, you know, if you look at the DNA of both the Huskies and Marquette's team, like, Washington's got a better group of talent. Marquette overachieved this season. So they were able to do that, and then they go out and they play the Mexico team, which I thought would go farther than it did, but Hobson had that bad wrist. And unfortunately, the Mountain West didn't collectively show up. No one got to the Sweet 16. They are dangerous, and they can take out West Virginia if they insist on running the ball up and down the floor all night long, because Truck Bryan is out. You know, he wasn't a great point guard, but he was competent, and he's a good free throw and three-point shooter. maybe good for only 9 or 10 points a game, but I think that has a compound impact. So Washington's completely flying under the radar. I made a joke that, you know, I don't even know if that team's going to get press credentials in Syracuse because no one is talking about that team. It's as if they've been completely forgotten because they're tucked away up in the northwest part of the country and the Pac-10's been terrible. But definitely a sleeper to get to the Elite Eight. And then if they played Kentucky, it would be interesting, but I wonder if Kentucky wouldn't force them into too many turnovers and too many bad shots. It's going to be really hard for them to get out of the East, but they can keep it interesting and can upset West Virginia, no doubt about it.
Matt, we unfortunately are out of time, but thank you so much to Matt Norlander. He runs collegehoopjournal.com. You can also find him in the Dagger, Yahoo's college basketball blog. We take a quick commercial break and back with more with Jim Clemens in just a moment. And we are talking basketball, specifically March Madness, and we remind everybody from our visit with Matt Norlander last segment, we taped late in the week. It was good to get Matt's take on some of the underdogs heading into the Thursday and Friday night games. As you listen to the show, you're probably looking at your Elite Eight right now, and I think a lot of us hope that at least one or two of these lower seeds are in it, just because the Cinderella stories are so much fun. But Jimmy, one of the stories that jumped out at me of the first round of the tournament, and I thought Matt nailed it, was some of the seeding was so ridiculous. Looking at Notre Dame and Louisville with those six seeds, and in particular, the really disappointing performance of the Big East. We heard all year long about the dominant power conference. Four teams go out in the first round. Villanova should have. Then Villanova gets smoked in the second round, as do Pittsburgh. It appears that we may have overrated the Big East a little bit, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and that's disappointing because everyone was talking about how great the Big East was this year, and then when it came time to show, they didn't. And I think, you know, that's why the hype, when we talk about expanding the tournament and should everybody be in, I'm saying once again, why not? Because a lot of this stuff is, I think, hyperbole. I think the media in certain markets get on teams and they aren't as good as everyone would like them to be. And you do, have these quote unquote small basketball universities and colleges around the country that obviously are playing pretty good ball because they aren't running out getting all these McDonald All-Americans and they leave them after a year. And you got a pretty good group of, juniors and seniors coming back to understand how to play together. It makes the game very interesting.
And you know, Wilkie, now of course I remind everybody, we're taping late Thursday evening. Sweet 16 games are underway because of our production needs to be heard around the country over the weekend. Syracuse, West Virginia certainly look to be legitimate potential championship teams. I'm not trying to jump all over the Big East, but now you even begin to wonder, you know, we gave them so much credit for coming through the Big East, one winning the regular season, the other winning the tournament. Suddenly, those resumes aren't quite as impressive, are they?
No, I still think that Syracuse, by any measure, is an elite team. I think West Virginia can be that good on its best day. I think while we might have overrated the conference as a whole, I still think the top of the conference is very good. And I think what you've seen is that the very best teams in that conference have come through. Syracuse winning its first two games by a combined 45 points. West Virginia, I think was a little bit less impressive, but they handled a Missouri team that plays a very difficult style of play and handled them well. So nonetheless, I still think you give those teams their credit, but I think that there was, you know, certainly a little bit of overrating that went on with the Big East this year, certainly.
Well, and Jimmy, we look at, you know, Wisconsin's a very good basketball team and Kansas had great talent. Cornell was flat out a better team than Wisconsin, but I look at that Northern Iowa Kansas game, and Northern Iowa is a good ball club. Fukmanesh and Eaglesider, they're definitely big time college ball players. But Kansas, if they played six more times, would win at least five of them, maybe all six. How do you explain what happens to a team like Kansas in a game like that?
There's a movie, football movie out that I just absolutely adore called Any Given Sunday, and unfortunately, or fortunately as it may be, that's why you play the game. That's why college tournaments, high school tournaments across the country, that's what makes it exciting, because you don't know if it's your team's night or not. And that's why coaches and players alike, you talk about one game at a time, and people wonder, what does that mean? And that's exactly what it means. That West Virginia, their point guard is out now. Michigan State, you know, they lost a good player. it can happen, and that's what dreams are built around, and that's what makes it so much fun, and that's why you only have the moment, and as a coach and as a player, you look back and you say, well, if this had only happened, and sometimes dreams do come true.
Jimmy, it's such a great point, because at the end of the day, there's lots of good basketball games at various levels, but it's these Cinderella stories and these upsets that make the tournament one of the great events in all of sports. We've got to take another quick commercial break here. We will sign off with Coach Clemens. He's got to get out to some Lakers games, and we'll talk to him again next week, because we're getting ready to go football right now. We've got NFL Way We Hear It coming up next. It is NFL Way We Hear It time here at Pro Football Weekly. Owners meetings going on earlier this week in Orlando, Florida, and a bunch of news popping out. We start with senior editor Eric Edholm, and one of his ball clubs, the Philadelphia Eagles, were at the focal point of a lot of those stories as Andy Reid basically switched course, Eric, and after saying repeatedly that Donovan McNabb is my quarterback, he indicated to the media that the Eagles were going to listen to offers for any or all of their three quarterbacks.
Yeah, that's probably the most interesting development. Reed's not known as a guy who gives a lot of information to we ink-stained wretches. But, it was interesting to hear him say this. And, he didn't rule out that the team is getting offers for McNabb, for Kevin Cobb, for Michael Vick. And, you know, it's just not real clear right now what direction they're heading. But just personally speaking, I'm as convinced now more than ever that I think McNabb is the guy that they would be willing to trade. And there have been reports that they may be willing to accept a second round pick in exchange. So that would kind of come down from the first round expectations many people had before Andy Reid spoke.
You do have to wonder though, Eric, if you're only going to get a second round choice, why do it? I mean, this is a team that has filled a number of needs during the offseason and free agency. They're going to get a bunch of players back who were injured last year. They're already a contender with a McNabb at quarterback. As soon as you go to Kevin Kolb, you got a guy with two starts. They were good starts, but boy, it seems to me like you're really rolling the dice for a second round draft choice.
Yeah, I think this is probably a similar situation to what Aaron Rodgers had up in Green Bay. You know, he had 3 years basically to sit and learn behind Brett Favre. I think there are a lot of people in that organization who feel like Kolb is ready to take over despite the lack of experience. But, you know, it's just a trend on offense. You look, you know, they've now gotten rid of Kevin Curtis. They've traded away Reggie Brown. Sean Andrews was an injury and a salary cap consideration, or not cap consideration, but contract consideration. You know, so all of a sudden, 24, 25, 26-year-old guys throughout the offense, it kind of would fit with what their trend has been recently.
All right, now, Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. Eric, I have this image of him surfing the owners' meetings looking for the biggest pile of microphones he could find. And he is his own GM. We've got to give him that. And he obviously does know some football. But why would he need to sit with the media and suggest and tantalize with the possibility that he expects, maybe even hopes, his second-string running back, Felix Jones, to beat out his starter, Marion Barber III?
And Jerry has a way of looking like he's trying to avoid the media and yet somehow finding them every time. It's amazing. But, you know, this debate about whether Marion Barber should be starting or whether Felix Jones should be starting, essentially it's irrelevant. I mean, what the more important thing is, who's going to get the more carries? I think there has been a tendency to want to get Jones in the lineup. The problem is he's been injured. You know, when he's been in there, he's done really good things. You know, there's the idea of thinking that he could expand his game as a receiver, be that breakaway threat that Barber isn't. So it's kind of an interesting debate, and I think Jerry, in theory, would like to have Barber as kind of a closer, you know, kind of a guy who can beat up a worn-down defense that has been chasing quicker backs like Felix Jones and Tashard Choice all game.
Well, and interestingly, it's actually both of them, Barber and Jones, who've been nicked up and banged up pretty regularly, and then you got Tashard Choice. It's certainly a nice problem to have. Eric, thank you for your help on those stories. We now welcome in Associate Editor Michael Blunda, and one of Michael's clubs, the Kansas City Chiefs, made a big move. They went out and got Thomas Jones. He of the 1,400 rushing yards and 14 touchdowns last year for the New York Jets. And yet, Michael, you're hearing that Jamaal Charles, the incumbent, could still very well be the starter in spite of the pretty decent money that they've spent on Thomas Jones?
Yeah, that's the way it sounds, Hub. Jamaal Charles really was a dynamic presence for the Chiefs offense the second half of last season. He rushed for 968 yards, 7 touchdowns in the final 8 games. And the Chiefs really like what they have in him. You know, he's kind of undersized, which is why they went out and got a guy like Thomas Jones, and they feel like pairing those two together could give them a pretty good presence going forward in that backfield.
Well, and it's interesting. You've got Charlie Weiss there, the genius offensive coordinator. If you don't believe it, just ask him. And, you know, he doesn't have necessarily the passing game that he would like, and yet you don't think of going out and getting a Charlie Weiss and then asking him to run a ground-based offense.
Yeah, that's true. And Jamal Charles is a very skilled pass catcher as well. So having a guy like that gives the Chiefs a lot of options. You'd think that Charlie Weiss would be a pass-first type coordinator. You know, Matt Cassel will have a lot of pressure on him this year to get better. But having a guy like Charles in the backfield and now having Jones gives the Chiefs at least some nice options in case the passing game isn't working.
All right, Michael, thank you. I'm going to have you hand the mic off to Dan Parr real quickly. Dan Parr, associate editor on the New York Jets, who let Thomas Jones get away. They did it so they could bring in LaDainian Tomlinson. And now, Dan, we're hearing rumblings that Rex Ryan sees him as possibly a little bit more than just a backup running back.
Yeah, we were expecting a very limited role for LT in this offense he was joining in New York, but Rex Ryan came out at the owners' meetings and said that, hypothetically, he's going to be a 15-carry per game back. That caught a lot of people off guard, maybe including LT, I don't know. But you would think that it's going to be very much depending on circumstances. The Jets have Sean Green, who came on strong in the postseason last year. The Jets really envision him as their back of the future. And Leon Washington is going to be back healthy next year, too. And he's a guy who's able to take a few carries every game. So whether there's going to be 15 for LT every week, I'm not sure that that's actually going to be the case. But I think Rex Ryan really wants to go out of his way to show respect to that player right now.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick commercial break here. But NFL owners meeting, that means lots of NFL way we hear it. And we've got a lot more coming in just a moment. Hub Arkish and Mike Wilkening back with more Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News NFL way we hear it. We are now joined by Executive Editor Dan Arkish. And Dan, a mysterious story in San Francisco, an unfortunate story in San Francisco, one that involves the personal life of their former general manager, Scott McLuhan, and we're going to stay away from some of the personal details, but the bottom line is that a month short of the NFL college draft, their top personnel guy is no longer with the ball club. What is the impact that you see on the 49ers right now?
This has been in the works for a while now. It's an unfortunate situation, and the timing makes it look like the Niners are sort of a rudderless ship, which, you know, they've had that reputation before. But they actually have things pretty well in hand as far as the draft, which is really their top priority. You know, they have two mid-round picks in that first round, and they really feel that Director of Player Personnel Trent Baalke and Director of Pro Personnel Tom Gamble together can kind of keep the organization afloat and until after the draft, and then Jed York, the new young guy in charge of the Niners, will figure out what to do next.
Well, and Baalke and Gamble, both highly respected around NFL circles, particularly Trent Baalke, who I have to assume will be a candidate for McLuhan's job. But the key is they've got those two picks. What do they do after the draft, and does this mean that Mike Singletary gets to stretch his legs a little bit more on the personnel side and in the front office?
I'll answer the last part of that first. I think Singletary, you know, acknowledges that as far as talent evaluation goes, that is not his strong suit. I mean, he is going to be more involved, but really I think the main guys are going to continue to be Baalke and Gamble. Now, whether or not Jed York goes out there and looks for a heavyweight to become the GM, as many people think he should, that just remains to be seen. Right now, it's just kind of moving forward toward that draft, and we'll see what happens after that.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. I'm going to now get back to Mike Wilkening here in studio with me. And, Wilkie, a couple of your ball clubs in the news. We'll get to the Steelers. It's going to be a weekly check until something really breaks on this story. But before we talk about the situation in Pittsburgh, Mike Holmgren and the Cleveland Browns, you would think, do need a young quarterback now. Now, I know they've brought in Jake Delhomme, but they've peddled both Derek Anderson and Brady Quinn, and yet Holmgren had some less than complimentary things to say about one of the top young quarterbacks in this coming draft, didn't he?
Yeah, I asked about Jimmy Clausen. He told the Cleveland Plain Dealer, quote, "I wish I liked him more," unquote. I don't know necessarily if this is something where he was not being entirely mean to Jimmy Clausen, but I think it pretty much spelled out that I think the Browns probably aren't going in that direction in round one. So the question is, what do they do to address the quarterback position? Because clearly, as you mentioned, Hub, they do need one. I don't think they're going to go in with just Seneca Wallace and also Jake Delhomme and Brett Ratliff. I think another guy is going to be added to the mix. They have multiple picks in later rounds, 3 picks in the third round. Maybe they look in that direction. They're having quarterbacks in for visits. Colt McCoy is one from Texas that's coming in. You know, he's a guy that probably may not go in round one. So, you know, certainly his name, I think, is going to be linked to them. But yeah, I think, Hub, at some point, they're going to take a quarterback in this draft. They have more than enough picks to do it. And as we know, Holmgren's had some success finding guys in the lower rounds. And so whomever he takes, I think at that point, you have to start thinking of that quarterback of the future type term to be applied to that person.
And Mike, no significant developments in Pittsburgh where they clearly have a quarterback issue. We do know that the Milledgeville police, actually the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, has now said they will not request DNA samples from Ben Roethlisberger. We know he's been accused. He has not been charged with any kind of sexual misconduct. And we know that the Steelers and the NFL will wait until the story plays out, as will we in doing a proper job of reporting it. But what we did hear this week is both head coach Mike Tomlin of the Pittsburgh Steelers and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell stating they are concerned. Tomlin saying he's very concerned, and Goodell saying he will be speaking to Roethlisberger at some point, regardless of how this plays out.
Right. That's the key news from this week, I think. Again, it's an ongoing investigation, but, you know, it's out there publicly now that this is on Roger Goodell's radar and something that's going to be addressed. You know, not much new light to shed other than that, but clearly, at this point, as this plays out, it's something that it's not a matter that's settled just yet between the NFL and Ben Roethlisberger.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. We take one more commercial break, and we've got the Publisher's Pen coming up next on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Well, Mike, certainly all of our listeners have heard by now that the biggest news coming out of the NFL owners' meetings in Orlando, Florida this past week is a change in the overtime rules in the playoffs. Right now, the rule reads, if the team that wins the coin toss scores a field goal, the opposition will get the football and a chance to either score a field goal to tie the game or a touchdown to win the game. Should they tie the game with a field goal, it then becomes sudden death. Now, I've got two big problems with this. My first is, well, why, if the first team that gets the ball scores a touchdown, the other team doesn't get a chance? It's still not fair. It was still dictated by the coin toss, and I don't think it's reasonable. My second question, why the playoffs only? Now, we're being told that the owners will consider this as a regular season rule as well at their next round of meetings in Dallas in May. But what if a team misses the playoffs by one game because they lost a game in overtime where they never got the football and a chance to score? It still challenges the credibility of the playoffs. I don't understand why you would go change a rule and come up with a better rule but not the right rule. Why fix part of the problem without fixing the whole problem? Hopefully the NFL will reconsider and take this rule change a little bit further. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Our thanks to Steve Kyler, the publisher at HoopsWorld.com, Matt Norlander from CollegeHoopsJournal.com, and The Dagger at Yahoo's College Basketball Blog. Randy Myers, our producer and engineer. Our home studio is Syndication Networks. And most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate it. Hopefully we'll see you again next week, same time, same station, at Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.